Hey everyone, my name is Alex Avina. I'm an associate professor of history at Arizona State University. So after pleading with Cena for weeks on end, he promised that he would unlock a current episode that I recorded for the bonus feed with Dr. Nema Alamri on her brilliant work on the history of diasporic Yemeni workers who went to Britain and in the United States throughout the 20th century. But Cena, the condition that he gave me for unlocking this bonus episode was for all of you to go to patreon.com and become a patron of East as a Podcast, as I have, one of my favorite podcasts. I listened to it faithfully, and it was a great honor for me to have guest hosted the episode with Dr. Alamri. So please, please, please don't make me look foolish with Cena. Go and sign up on patreon.com, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Thank you, everyone. Welcome, Dr. Nema Alamri, to the show. My name is Alex Avina. I am taking over Cena's podcast momentarily. And I'd like to welcome Professor Dr. Nema Alamri to the show. Please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your interests and your work.
Thank you so much. Sure. Yeah, my name is Nema Alamri. I received my PhD in the spring of 2020, last year, in interdisciplinary humanities from the University of California, Merced. This past year, I was a postdoctoral fellow at Princeton University, where I taught courses on Arab-American history, as well as a course on race, labor, and empire, as well as, of course, work on my first book project. I'm currently back on the job market, continuing to work on my book project, which looks at histories of labor, migration, and empire in the Yemeni diaspora throughout the 20th century. And specifically, I'm interested in the ways in which Yemeni immigrants and workers in the diaspora utilized their identities as Arabs, Muslims, and laborers to make space in places that were really not intended for them, and also just to challenge social injustices on both local and global scales.
Yeah, no, this is great. This is the reason why I thought about inviting you to the show, as we kind of were discussing before we started recording, was that I first encountered your work at this academic conference in 2016 about Yemeni field workers and laborers who were in the United Farm Workers Union, made famous by its leader, Cesar Chavez, during the 1970s, yeah. Right? And it was for me, it was a really interesting, as you mentioned in your dissertation and your work, it's a completely marginalized history, right? So, you also have this broader focus, right, on the history of labor and empire in the Yemeni diaspora, on how Yemeni workers and activists balance these local struggles to both live and make a living within what you call these global politics of empire. So maybe one way to start talking about your project is really to talk about your own personal connection to this history, to this interdisciplinary history that you trace, right? So maybe we can start there, talking about your own personal connections to it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, so for me, I think my research has been in many ways a sort of retracing of my own family's diasporic formations and history. So just to sort of give a little bit of personal background on my family and where my family and personal experiences fit into my research. Also on my mom's side of the family, my great grandfather worked as a sailor on British ships, really throughout the 1940s and 1950s, and traveled to different port cities around the world. And then eventually he ended up staying in New York, in Brooklyn. And then from there, my grandfather came, and then eventually in 1965, he brought in his wife and children, including my mother, who was just a baby at the time. And so they lived in Brooklyn. And then on my father's side of the family, my grandfather, so my father's father, was also a sailor, but he migrated to England. He was a sailor on British ships. He migrated to England, where he worked for many years in the steel industry in Sheffield during the 1950s and 1960s, where many of other hundreds and hundreds of Yemenis worked at the time in England as well. My father, on the other hand, he didn't leave Yemen until 1975 as a young man somewhere in his early 20s. And he first came to Dearborn, Michigan, where he thought he was going to work in the auto industry, but eventually traveled to California to work in agriculture as a farm worker, where many, many Yemenis were working, which, you know, we'll talk about in a bit. And then he then moved to Southern California and worked for a long time in the food service industry there. So that's just sort of family sort of history background. And so when I began this research, the first person I interviewed was actually my father, whose experiences as a farm worker in the 1970s during the farm worker movement was, I think, in many ways, the genesis of this project. I mean, I grew up hearing stories from my dad, and he's this like amazing storyteller. Like, once he starts telling a story, you can't get him to stop. And I think this is where I get my love for history is really from him. And just hearing about his experiences as a farm worker at the time, and just how the energy of the farm worker movement sort of intersected with his migration experiences, like, that just really fascinated me. I mean, he attended Cesar Chavez's rallies and talked about that. So I was just always really interested in this history. And I also saw that there was, you know, very little historical scholarship on this history in California specifically, but really just about the Yemeni diaspora more generally. And so when I started to do the archival research and talk with folks, it was just really cool to see how my father's experiences were being reflected in the archive and in the sources that I was finding, and also just to see how my family's experiences more broadly were being reflected in this larger story about the Yemeni diaspora that my project is sort of attempting to tell.
No, that's great. I mean, I think, let me ask you, because mm-hmm. you have such a direct personal connection to this history, have you received any sort of like, potentially like negative feedback from like more old school historians who will cast doubt on the supposed objectivity of your historical research because of your close connections to the subject? I mean, I think, yeah. I'm a historian. I love talking shit about my craft and my discipline because it is such an inherently conservative discipline.
Yes.
And you know, I've seen others receive that type of pushback when their own family history or personal connections to the subject will then lead other historians to read their work in a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think this rings true, particularly for scholars of color, right? I've been lucky enough to not experience that sort of explicitly, but I've definitely have felt that implicit bias for sure. But I think what historians of color who are doing work that they're personally connected to have long demonstrated is that actually, the work is better. The work is more critical because not because of the sort of additive model or sort of like liberal politics of inclusion, but actually because we bring a particular set of knowledges and ways of knowing and experiences that allow us to ask questions and to look at sources in ways that haven't been looked at before. I've definitely experienced my fair share of imposter syndrome when it comes to the discipline of history. To be clear, I've certainly experienced that. But I mean, I'm just really, I'm inspired by other scholars doing this work, and that sort of empowers me to find validity in the work that I do. I mean, to just for full transparency, when I went into graduate school, I didn't think I was going to do this project. While this history was always sort of a personal passion, and sort of for myself, and was always close to my heart because it's so close to my family, I didn't always think that it would be valued in an academic space, which is, you know, crazy to think that I was sort of conditioned to think that way. But I think a lot of young graduate students starting graduate school, going into history departments, feel that way. I was lucky enough to be surrounded by mentors, you know, like my dissertation advisor, Mario Cifuentes, and other faculty and colleagues who are doing similar work. And that, you know, definitely validated, I think, for me, the work that I'm doing.
No, it's great to be mentored by troublemakers like Dr. Cifuentes. Yeah. So shout out exactly. to Mario. Mario's a good friend, so it's okay. We carry on in that way. It's also particularly challenging for a historian who's working from like an anti-imperialist or anti-colonial perspective, right? Which is what you do in your broader research agenda and research mm-hmm. project. There's this great quote from the late Australian anthropologist Inga Clendenin. She has a lot of research on indigenous peoples in Mexico in the pre-colonial era. Mm-hmm. She has this quote in this article on Hernan Cortes, in which he basically says pretty much every historian that's written on Cortes is a camp follower of the imperialists. So in a way like that, this discipline is structured in that way, right? So there's also particular challenges for those of us working within this discipline to kind of explode that and I guess work from the other side, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and I think that goes back to a lot of methodological questions in the discipline. I'll just go on a rant if we get into this topic now, but
rants are good.
I mean, I think indefinitely sort of the obstacles that I faced in the archives and sort of the challenges of finding sources, and not necessarily because they weren't there, but because they weren't being categorized properly, right? So no tags, no descriptions, no translations, so that the archivist didn't know what a particular document was, if it was written in Arabic. All of those things pose sort of methodological questions for history as a discipline, and sort of pushes, I think, to go beyond the sort of clinical ways that history sort of approached, right? This narrative or this fictional idea that history is objective, that the archive is objective, right? That we know that that's not the case. So that's definitely something that I've thought a lot about in pursuing this research.
Cool. Yeah, I think, I mean, as a historian, I love listening to archive stories, like actual stories of folks who go into the archives, because in many ways, those stories reveal the lack of neutrality that archives represent, right? So, but we can get back to that, because, yeah, no, I could go, you know, I could talk rant about that forever, too. So let's just, before we jump into, you know, I obviously am obsessed with your work on the Yemeni field workers and the United Farm Workers of Central California, but I also want to talk about your broader dissertation. So to talk about your broader dissertation, could you please, you know, give us like a brief historical background or context to help situate your focus on the Yemeni diaspora?
Sure. Yeah. So the history that I trace in my research basically starts with, of course, British colonization in Aden in South Yemen, beginning sort of the late 19th and early 20th century. And then my research sort of ends somewhere in the 1970s and early 1980s. And I could talk about why I think this period is interesting in studying the Yemeni diaspora and sort of specifically global politics of empire. But first, to just give some context to this time period. So in 1839, the British gained power over the southern region of Yemen and created the British Protectorate of Aden. And so the port of Aden becomes this really key location, primarily for the British East India Company throughout their travels to India, where the company was based, of course. And while Yemenis were initially hired to work at the docks in Aden, they eventually found work on British ships, where from there many traveled to Britain, other parts of the world. Those that traveled to Britain, a lot of them stayed there and worked in the shipping industry. And I have a chapter that covers some of the experiences there. But just to be clear, I mean, while prior to British colonial presence, Yemenis had been migrating for, you know, hundreds of years, primarily in surrounding regions, including Africa, such as Djibouti and Ethiopia, However, British imperial presence in the mid-late 19th century really opened up labor migration to other parts of the world, including Britain and the U.S. So we see that the ways in which British colonialism has this really defining moment for the Yemeni diaspora. It's not until the 1960s and 1970s that we begin to see more significant number of Yemenis coming into the U.S. And this is for a couple of reasons. So one of them being the 1965 Hart-Celler Act, which of course ended restrictive immigration policies in the U.S. and allowed for more immigrants from Yemen to come to the U.S. And then secondly, we see more Yemenis coming during the 60s and 70s to the U.S. because of political shifts and economic struggles happening in Yemen in the 1960s and 1970s, which led to more labor migration and the need to migrate for work. So in 1967, South Yemen successfully decolonized Aden, ending over 100 years of British imperial presence in the region, and officially becomes a Marxist regime known as the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. And of course, those sort of Marxist politics coming from South Yemen definitely radicalize and politicize Yemeni workers in the U.S. And we see this play out in the farm worker movement. Meanwhile, in North Yemen, in 1968, the ruling monarchy was overthrown and the Republic of Yemen was formed. And so with both of these events in Yemen, the collapse of the economy due to both decolonization in the south and war in the north, right, labor essentially becomes Yemen's largest economic export, right, which is still the reality today for Yemen's economy. And we see an increased need primarily for young men to travel elsewhere for work to support their families. And so throughout the 1960s and 70s, thousands of Yemenis came to the U.S. Many of them found jobs in automobile factories in Michigan, where there was sort of the booming auto industry in the 50s, 60s, steel plants in New York, and of course, agricultural farms in California. And so in covering this sort of really long period from British colonization to decolonization, post-war, and then sort of all the way to the 1970s, I was really interested in tracking the creation, right? So not only the creation of a Yemeni diaspora, specifically in the West, which again, I think we can trace back to British colonization, but also interrogating these shifting politics of empire from sort of formal British empire and colonization in the first half of the 20th century, and then to growing U.S. imperialism in the Middle East post-war, right, specifically throughout the Cold War in the 1960s and 1970s. And so that shift of politics of empire really gets played out in the sort of local labor politics that my chapters look at in England, in Michigan, and California. And so these sort of ruptures that the chapters look at, I think, demonstrate moments in which these global politics of empire were being played out, that are being played out on the global stage, are actually intersecting with these local labor politics in the Yemeni diaspora.
Yeah, I mean, reading your work, there's never a post-colonial moment, right? Like, and I think that's one of the great things about your dissertation, in the sense that you're working within a framework that doesn't assume that there's a post-colonial moment, despite like formal political developments in terms of kicking out the British and declaring independence from these two national entities in Yemen, right? Like that moment doesn't necessarily exist per se, right? The empire continues, just in a different variety, in different configurations. But there's that quote from the Sri Lankan writer, Sivandhanan, right? Like, we are here because you were there. Like, just right. Adopting that framework to understand diaspora and like migration would just radicalize the way people, at least in the US, would understand why people come here to begin with. It's because empire was elsewhere forcing these people to come here. That's one of the things I really love about your work.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, for me, the sort of framework of diaspora of empire was really helpful there to not sort of think about a post-colonial moment, but to think about colonization and empire as being contemporaneous and ongoing, whether these impacts are happening or continuing to be played out today, for sure.
And then they encounter different colonial configurations when they get to like the field workers in California, the agricultural fields, these factories really in the fields in California, right? It's a different colonial configuration well, it's a settler colonial one that we can talk about in a bit if you want. But before we get dive into the part that I'm like obsessed with, you want to say something about just in terms of how Yemenis who are coming to the U.S. were racialized in contrast to previous generations of Arab Americans who were coming to the U.S. I think that's really important to kind of unpack, right? I remember reading in the most recent biography of Edward Said that came out recently, like I was shocked to learn that his father had come to the U.S. and actually had fought for the U.S. in World War I, right? And I think if you look at legal proceedings in the early 20th century in the U.S., right, there's am I mistaken to say that Arab Americans or people who are trying to become Arab Americans were largely classified as white? And then there's a distinction, right? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, so yes, I think part of what I hope my research can do is to contribute to that, the history of the racialization of Arabs, because it's such a rich and interesting history that I think speaks to just the broader conversation about racial formation in the U.S. So in the early 20th century, Arabs the late 19th, early 20th century, Arabs were predominantly classified as white. And the vast majority of early Arab migrants were Syrian Christian immigrants. And so I think, and there's, you know, such a rich body of scholarship on this. I mean, Sarah Gualtieri yes. has a fabulous book, Beyond Arab and White, or Between Arab and White. And so so I think in many ways, right, for Syrians, for example, their Christianity and in many cases owning property. So a lot of these were sort of middle-class immigrants that were able to acquire property in the U.S. So between owning property and being Christian sort of allowed sort of entry into claims to whiteness. And in many cases in the legal proceedings that you're talking about, they were successful for the most part in claiming whiteness. That category was of course unstable, right? Yes. And this is the case for many of the groups at the time. But yes, for the most part, Arabs were able to claim whiteness successfully. For Yemenis, on the other hand, this wasn't the case. So one of the earliest examples of this is a court case that I talk about in my research of Ahmed Hassan, who was a Yemeni immigrant in 1942, applied for citizenship based on whiteness in Michigan, and he was denied. And the courts, the presiding judge at the time, argues that, you know, there's just no way that someone from Yemen could be white due to their religious affiliation of, you know, the quote unquote being a Mohammedan's peoples, and sort of the inability of people from that world to assimilate to Western civilization.
Yeah.
And so there was already in the courts in the 40s, this sort of common knowledge that, you know, Yemenis were unable to assimilate. And so that sort of discourse, I think, continues, you know, throughout the 20th century, and I think is certainly reflected in even the scholarship on Yemenis in the U.S., right? This idea that Yemenis are sort of traditional, backwards, and unable to assimilate, I think preempts a lot of better questions that we could ask in pursuing this sort of this historical work. And so definitely one of the arguments that I'm pushing for in my research is to go beyond that that sort of sojourner category that Yemenis are being categorized as. Sojourner being someone who's here only temporarily, is unable to assimilate to the culture, quote unquote culture. And so I think we definitely need to go beyond just the sort of ethnic assimilation paradigm, right, that scholars have, you know, debunked yes. for years now. But I think for the case of Yemenis, I think that's still very much the narrative that gets told.
I mean, it's interesting I'm listening to you talk about the racialization of Yemenis in contrast to previous generations of Arab uh-huh. populations that came to the U.S. And to a certain extent, like the Yemenis from a legal sense were Mexicanized, right? I mean, because you look at the legal, there was Mexicans who tried to claim whiteness in various legal proceedings in the early 20th century, right? And it's similar. It was the same argument. And this is an argument that continues all the way up to God, Samuel Huntington's horrible thing right after the War on Terror, right? The Hispanic Challenge, where Mexicans are not able to be assimilated into the U.S. For them, it's not necessarily their Mohammedan or what, that language that you described that was applied to the Yemenis. It was their racial, I mean, they use this language, right? Their racially mongrelized status. Mm-hmm. But that then leads to them not being able to claim in many instances the category of white. And then the other part about the sojourners, right? So in 1924, we get this, the National Origins Act, right? Which is this immigration act that pretty much cuts off the rest of the world from coming to the United States legally as migrants, with the exception of the Western Hemisphere and certain Nordic countries of Europe. One of the justifications that was given for not including Mexicans in that category is precisely because they were represented by agribusiness representing Congress peoples as sojourners. So there's this great quote from a Texas congressperson saying essentially, you know, Mexicans are like homing pigeons. They'll come here to work, but then they'll go back. There's no way that their kids are going to become professionals, college professors, lawyers, teachers, et cetera, et cetera. That quote, I love thinking about that quote, right? Because my parents came as undocumented migrants, and here we are still to this day, right? But that it's really interesting, right? So in obviously different inflections and valences, but the Yemeni diaspora that comes after 1940, after the 1940s, in many ways kind of goes through a lot of the same things that these Mexican migrant populations went through beginning the 20th century.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the threads that we could see there with these two histories, I think, is class, right? So that historically class has been able to warrant whiteness to particular immigrant groups at particular historical moments, which I think played into the ways in which Syrians were racialized as white, and then later how Yemenis were not racialized as white. Definitely.
Sorry, everyone, to barge in on the episode, but can you make clear to people that Syrians also includes modern Lebanon as well? Like, because, and also, I think at that time in the early 20th century, Iraq too, right? Like, it was just like a term.
Yes.
Maybe not Iraq, actually. I'm not sure about that. But it means Lebanese and Syrian generally.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I was just curious myself. I'm going to edit this out.
Yeah, thank you, Sina, for that. Thank you. You're
because people hear Syrians and they think, oh, Assad, whatever. Like
Ottoman provinces. Ottoman provinces at the time, which encompassed Syria, modern day Syria, Lebanon. For sure.
And you have that not even just to the U.S., but it's a diaspora out even to Latin America, right? So like you have a soccer club in Chile called Palestino, right? That's founded by these Palestinian migrants from like the early 20th century. So it's interesting that diaspora goes throughout the Americas as well from as you referred to as the Ottoman or formerly Ottoman provinces.
Exactly. Right.
Let's just jump into, to your work on Yemeni workers and how they field workers in the Central Valleys of California during the 1970s and their relationship to the United Farm Workers Union organized by Cesar Chavez. Now, just to be clear, like your work that we're discussing today, on the one hand, it's your dissertation called Long Live the Arab Worker. And then you also published in this really wonderful online journal called Boom California, an article that focuses on your dissertation chapter that has to do with Yemeni workers and the United Farm Workers. So do you want to jump in and discuss in terms of, and this is really, it takes you to your personal connection as well, like kind of lay out like what's going on in California's, these agricultural factories in the field in the 60s and 70s and the role that Yemeni field workers play in organizing these field workers against the bosses.
Mm-hmm. I think the agricultural system in the 60s and 70s, I think, much like today, was a system that benefited growers and corporations and exploited the workers. And so when, Yemenis arrived in the late 50s, 60s, and then 60s and 70s, they faced many obstacles, the low wages, language barriers, right, lack of translators, limited access to healthcare and social services. So it's easy to see how the United Farm Workers Union became an appealing organization for Yemenis to gravitate towards. I mean, I talked about the historical context that sort of started labor migration in the first place and the politics that were happening in Yemen, Yemenis brought those politics with them to California. And so both decolonization in the South and the end of the monarchy in the North and sort of all of these political shifts. And then, of course, Arab nationalism, like anti-colonial Arab nationalism sweeping the Arab region at the time. I think all of those things politicized Yemeni workers in a way that made the UFW rate sort of recognizable and appealing, especially for folks that had political organizing back in Yemen. So many of the Yemeni UFW organizers had some type of political organizing prior to coming to California. And again, that they brought those Arab nationalist politics. And in the research that I have on this chapter sort of looks at how that put the UFW, I think, in interesting positions to consider global questions of empire, and particularly the question of Palestine, that I think had Yemenis not been present, the union and the movement would not have come face to face with.
I mean, it's just this wonderful, the other way to pose this question is how did Nasser end up in the California fields? Right. And we can think about kind of, at first hand, it seems like out of place, right? That you have these Yemeni field workers marching and striking, carrying portraits of Nasser. Because as you describe, right, the work and the literature on the UFW tends to describe it as a mostly Mexican-American field worker organization, with also an important, and as the more recent literature has shown, also an important Filipino field worker components as well.
Right,
But then, and it's also, if I'm not mistaken, like it's somewhat like culturally conservative in the sense that it's like influenced by a certain reading of Catholicism, right? So then we get these Yemeni mm-hmm. field workers who are marching around carrying Nasser's image, right? So how do Yemenis push and contest and the UFW in general during the 1970s?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, so just to sort of backtrack a bit to give some context for those that may not be familiar. So in August 1973, during one of the union strikes, a man by the name of Nagy Dayfullah, a young Yemeni farm worker and UFW organizer, was killed by a deputy sheriff in Lamont, California. And so, you know, this moment becomes this really important moment, I think, in the history of the Yemeni diaspora and also the history of the UFW. And so during the funeral march for Nagy, Yemeni workers carried, as you mentioned, a large portrait of Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, right, who's this pro-Palestinian Arab leader, very much controversial and sort of broadly disliked in U.S. politics. And the sources that I was looking at, it was really interesting to see the impact that the inclusion of this one portrait had for the UFW and the Yemeni community. And so I think Yemenis turned to Arab nationalism, right, which is sort of symbolized by that portrait of Nasser, for the same reasons they turned to the UFW, right? The sort of discourse surrounding social justice was appealing, and anti-colonial Arab nationalism circulating in the Arab world at the time focused on empowering Arab people to fight for their rights, and whether that took the form of decolonial movements in Arab countries or farm worker justice in the Central Valley, right? This sort of history connects these two things that are happening both globally and locally. And so what happens when Yemenis carry this portrait is, you know, on the one hand, the UFW respected the Yemeni community's choice to march with Nasser's portrait and did not contest this at the time. But on the other hand, they were not prepared at all, I think, for the consequences of being affiliated with this pro-Palestinian Arab leader who, again, had this like controversial reputation. And so, during my archival research, I found, you know, dozens of letters from supporters to Cesar Chavez and to the UFW following Nagy's death, supporters that were just completely outraged that an image of Nasser was, you know, printed in you know, all of these newspapers that were covering the story at the time, and, you know, threatened their solidarity with the UFW and said, you know, how could you include this pro-Palestinian leader? And so the UFW was definitely forced to reckon with these questions. and ultimately, you know, issued a statement in support of the state of Israel, right? And so, and the other thing, the other relationship that was sort of threatened was also with the AFL-CIO. So alongside just supporters, there was also like, you know, real institutional threat that was coming to the UFW. And so that threat, both from local pro-Israeli organizations and with the AFL-CIO, which boosted, I think, the union's platform really to a national level, I think ultimately that the threat of that institutional support, I think, ultimately led to the UFW supporting the state of Israel in the end. And then in terms of support for the Yemeni community, I think, you know, by the late 1970s, a lot of Yemenis were leaving the UFW because they were not able to get the resources that they needed. In 1981, a former Yemeni UFW organizer opened up an organization in Delano, the Anti-Arab Discrimination Committee, and sort of that organization became a space to advocate for the Yemeni community. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting history to sort of think about how the farm worker movement had the potential to be, I think, an anti-colonial movement. And I think that was certainly possible with the communities that were there, right? So that Mexican, Filipino, Yemeni communities all have this shared history of colonialism or U.S. imperialism, right, in their homelands, and that being really the reason that we're all here in the first place. Yeah. And so I think there was, I think, that the real possibility for that. But it wasn't, it didn't live up to its potential.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was telling Sina before we started recording that in its earliest phase, the UFW actually like collaborated with the Border Patrol, right, to prevent right. undocumented migrants from coming into the U.S. in the aftermath right. of this 1965 Heller Act that completely changed the dynamics of legal migration to the U.S., right? I mean, they had like boats on the Rio Grande that were supposedly collaborating with the Border Patrol to prevent undocumented migrants from coming into the country and potentially, in their words or in their view, serving as strike breakers or scabs, right? But it's mm-hmm. so it's interesting to see how at different moments the UFW is being pushed, but it seems like the Arab nationalism and the anti-colonial pro-Palestinian stance, it was kind of like their limit. Whereas yeah. Cesar Chavez did step away from, attacking undocumented Mexican migrants. I was telling Sina also that my parents could not stand Cesar Chavez. Like they were because of his stance on undocumented migration. So I've always had this weird relationship with when he's being like celebrated and remembered. Right. But the limit was the radicalism that the Yemeni workers were practicing in the fields, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think it's obviously resonates to the contemporary moment where this continues to be a sort of polarizing question, yes. In so many, lines of work and certainly in academia. Right. And so I think this history is definitely sort of an early example of pro-Palestinian activism, intersecting with labor politics. And we definitely see the limitations of the particular type of social justice platform that Cesar Chavez and the UFW was utilizing, one that I think drew from sort of civil rights movement at the time, right? And sort of, again, I think this history pushes us to think about the limitations of these particular social justice narratives and hopefully a way for us then to imagine a world that we could go beyond and sort of think more globally about these issues.
Yeah, because it's also like, because the UFW is allied with the AFL-CIO, they're starting from an anti-communist, like a very like gringo, like Cold War anti-communist position, right? I mean, right. So it's also already like a limit politically. They're also limited from the very premise, at least the leadership,
right?
Whereas if you look at like kind of the field worker organizing that's going on in a similar geographic area in the 1930s, like you have outright communists out there organizing and fighting, right? Like in the famous cotton strike of the 1930s against some of the bosses, right? So I also think it's interesting how the UFW is already integrated into a broader global politics. They just don't know it, or they right. refuse to acknowledge it in that sense. But they're working from a very like U.S. anti-communist position to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and then to just also be clear, I mean, there were folks in the UFW at the time who were outraged when Chavez issued that statement in support of Israel. So I think that's important for us to say, too, that, again, that this history wasn't sort of simple, right? This was a very, like, complicated moment. So I think that's also really important to highlight, too, that folks in the UFW were also supporting Palestine and were writing letters to Chavez, you know, saying, you know, what would Nagy think? Nagy is a martyr for the UFW, and they, you know, are always sort of including him in these commemorative events. But at the same time, you know, politically speaking, are they really paying tribute to these communities?
Yeah, that's a really key point, right? I mean, the leadership doesn't translate into like the entire organization. I mean, essentially it's the leaders, it's the bottom, the rank and file that also pushed the UFW to adopt their anti-migrant stance as well, right? With the help of some Chicano students. Can I read, so you in your article, you included a part from Nagy Daifala's letter that he sends home to his father. And it really, I'm just going to read the selection that you included in the article, because it's such a cool, well, I don't know if cool is the right word, but it just grabbed me, right? The way that in this one description of the fields in California, he's reading it through, as you argue, through his experiences in Yemen, right? So I'm going to read it and then we can talk about it. He writes, quote, "Dearest father, you will be amazed at this, which I am writing to you in this letter about the prisons for workers in America. And when I tell you how much an agricultural worker suffers and endures in terms of severe ill will from the landlords of ranches. These workers live in encampments that resemble military barracks surrounded by barbed wire and a massive barrier of governmental agents who forbid anyone from contacting the workers or even conversing with their friends except by signals. Or when they are completely outside the camp where they are far from the police, the landowners do not permit the workers to work in agriculture except under laws the ranch owners impose on them with less than legal wages and insufficient safety precautions for the workers." I mean, that is like, that is, in a way, you know, like George Jackson somewhat at the same time is one of, you know, developing his theories on carcerality, right? And the American prison system. I was struck by this quote, like Nagy is giving his own, he's giving like a different layout of carcerality in the US as it relates to labor and field worker production, right? I was just struck by that.
Right. Yeah. It's really powerful, the letters that he wrote to his dad. So Nagy, like many young Yemenis, was financially supporting his parents and family back in Yemen, and would send these letters back to his parents. And they're originally written in Arabic, so the translation might not quite cross over, but I think definitely gets the spirit of what he's saying. And Nagy is a really interesting figure too, who's sort of been limited to his violent death and assassination and his sort of identity as a UFW martyr. But, you know, Nagy was very politically active, both as a UFW organizer and also back in Yemen. So he was arrested as a young man in Yemen, in South Yemen, and on a college campus in Aden, where he took down both the British flag and the Yemeni flag. And so he's
such coming. A cool story. That was an amazing story.
And so, I mean, I think it resonates into the language and the ways and the things that he's saying in his letters, right? That this is someone who's deeply aware of how systems of power operate and is sort of aware, you know, knows how to critique the system. He's seeing it as a system in the first place, right? And so I think that's really important to highlight, especially for someone like Nagy, who, again, I think has been ahistoricized and just sort of, you know, stripped of the nuances and political activity and political activist that he was in reality.
No, that's great. I mean, he's theorizing about how power works in the central valleys of California. And that's, you know, and not from an ivory tower, though, but from like both his experiences as a laborer in these fields, but then also from his political activity and militancy in Yemen, which is which gives it its power, right? So it's I just, when I read that bit, I'm like, God, this guy's like a theorist and a practitioner of, like, well, he's a theorist of how power works. And these fields, as you all know, right, these fields have a long history of really being the center point of right-wing conservative power in California, still to this day, right? So I was just struck by the language and the analysis that he used to essentially lay out how power works in the Central Valleys. And to a certain extent, we can make the argument, I don't know what you think, that power still works like that in the Central Valleys.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why these histories are so important to tell, because they resonate so much for not just the Yemeni community, but for so many communities, so many working class communities in the U.S., right? But yes, certainly Naji has emerged as a leader in the Yemeni American community, understandably so, because of his sort of acute awareness of how these systems of power are operating. And I love that you say sort of theorizing that. I mean, yeah, he was absolutely theorizing in these letters.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I mean, just the way that scholars have recently started to recover kind of like the writings of George Jackson in relation to carceral studies. Like, it'd be interesting to do something similar, to think about this in similar ways to Naji as theorizing something similar. I mean, it's just such a striking contrast to compare an agricultural field to a concentration camp, essentially what he's doing, right? In terms of surveillance and power and how power works. So I have one more specific history question and like a broader history question, because you mentioned the additive history model. And I definitely want to get to that. But before I ask you that one, do you want to talk more about, like, so you mentioned that by the late 70s, Yemeni field workers started to leave the UFW because it no longer served their needs and they weren't receiving the help that they deemed necessary. Do you want to talk about what happens, like what type of organizing happens in the 80s? I mean, I had never read the story of Alex Ode in until I read your work, and I went on this deep Google dive yesterday. Like, I spent like an hour researching this, and then I found out that he's like, so alleged most likely killers are like still alive, just out of the country with one state in particular protecting them. But before
it's crazy.
You know, do you want to talk about Yemenis in the 1980s and how, what type of organizing in the Central Valleys and sure. in Michigan they started to engage in?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, well, I'll first just start off by saying that Naji's death also had reverberations all the way to Michigan, so that when Yemeni and Arab auto workers, upon hearing about Naji's death in 73, that definitely politicized them to do some of the work that happens in the auto industry at the time surrounding the question of Palestine. So in the chapter that I have on Detroit, I talk about the formation of the Arab Workers Caucus in the 70s in the auto industry. That and the ways in which workers were criticizing the United Auto Workers Union at the time, who were purchasing Israeli bonds with the due memberships from the auto workers. And so I think in many ways, Naji's death was sort of, there's a rich scholarship on the formation of the Arab Workers Caucus and the sort of formation of Arab American third world left. Pamela Pennock has a great book on that. Rich scholarship there. But for me, I was really interested in sort of centering the experiences of Yemenis. And so, again, we see how the experiences of farm workers, Yemeni farm workers in California, were resonating with the auto workers in Michigan. So that activism that didn't come to fruition in California, I think, really plays itself out in successful ways in Detroit, understandably so, because there's a much larger Arab American community and a larger history of organizing there. But in terms of what happens by the late 70s and 80s in California, so by 1982, there's no record of Yemeni or Arab UFW organizers. And so in that same year, I talked about the individual person's name was Ahmed Shaibi, who was an organizer with the UFW. He stopped organizing with the UFW and established the Delano chapter of the American Anti-Arab Discrimination Committee. The ADC, I want to get that name right. I think I said it wrong earlier. And so for Shaibi, he sees this, you know, dire need for the organization to focus on the specific needs of the Yemeni community, something that the UFW, you know, did do for many years, to be sure, but I think was not capable of fully doing offering the needs that the community had. And so, you know, Shaibi talks about how, you know, nearly 90% Arabs inhabited nearly 90% of labor camps in Delano specifically, but there was nowhere they could go for social services. So he starts this organization. But by 1985, the ADC sort of disappears. So in Delano, there's the ADC in Delano closes. And I think a lot of that has to do with, as you mentioned, the murder of Palestinian American Alex Oda, who was the West Coast regional director of the ADC. And he was murdered by a bomb that was planted in his ADC office in Santa Ana. And so it's interesting to me that in that same year that Alex Oda is murdered in 1985, Ahmed Shaibi closes down the Delano office for the ADC. And this definitely was consistent upon my father's experiences, who was also somewhat involved politically. There was a little organization that him and some other Yemenis started to sort of advocate for issues in Yemen, as well as, you know, link their experiences here in the Central Valley. And I was really fascinated by this. I think my dad was the secretary for this club, and he kept meeting notes. And so I was like, oh my gosh, this is I just want to learn so much about this. He told me that he burned all of those documents. So he got rid of everything, all the record of the political work that he was doing. And he talked about Alex Oda and how that really scared a lot of Arabs in the Central Valley and Yemenis in the Central Valley who were doing political work. So, I think it's easy for us to sort of look back at this history and romanticize it. And I'm certainly guilty at that at times. But, you know, there was a real threat and sort of a fear of surveillance that many felt at the time.
Wow. Your father articulated that to you in terms of why he burned the papers?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I wasn't surprised because, I mean, we were certainly raised with the sort of fear of of surveillance and leaving records of that type of work and sort of not talking about these issues. So my parents are thrilled that I'm doing this work. No, they really are, though. But just to sort of conclude that history there by the 1980s, not only is there no UFW organizers, really the number of Yemeni farm workers in general sort of dwindles down. And partly that's because a lot of them go back to Yemen, but a lot of them also either leave for other types of work. So a lot of them move to the Bay Area and find work in the service industry. And then a lot of them open up small stores throughout the Central Valley. My dad owns a small corner shop in Selma. There's hundreds of small Yemeni owned businesses throughout the Central Valley. And that's a really rich history that I'm interested in sort of unpacking in the future.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yes. And I will gladly read that as well. So I hope you're able to undertake that research project as well. All right. So the broad, thank you so much. You have taken a bunch of your time, but the last broad historical question is in reference to something you mentioned earlier. And it's also in your work where you critique what you talk about, this additive model of history, particularly U.S. history, right? So as a way to expand U.S. history, you just add the experiences of marginalized groups, mm-hmm. but the broader frame, the content changes, expands, but the form remains the same. And I think your work is critical of that model. Do you have some thoughts on that in terms of this is our time to just talk shit about history, I guess, as a discipline?
Great. Perfect. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I think one of the reasons that Yemenis are sort of marginalized in the history, specifically with the UFW and then just broadly speaking, I think goes back first to the questions of the archives that we started to talk about. Mm-hmm. And so I do want to share a little bit about my experience in the archives. When I was doing research on the UFW, for example, I talked about how it was really challenging to locate items, and I would find folders of material sort of titled Arabic documents, right? So that quote unquote Arabic documents. So they're not historicized or specified in any ways that some of the other items in the collection were. And I think for me, right, so as historians, we're definitely conditioned to prioritize the written record, right? So the letters, the documents, certainly the institutional documents that are left behind. And so the archive sort of gets characterized as this neutral depository in which these objective sources are stored. But of course, as we've talked about, we know the archive is not neutral, and it's a living and breathing entity that's created and sustained by actual people. So In reality, it's flawed by design, right? So there's biases and limitations, etc. And so when it comes to the limitations of the archive, I'm really interested in sort of thinking about how, especially when it comes to marginalized communities and subjugated histories, how the archive, which is a place to preserve history, could also be a place where histories are being compromised or obscured. And so I think this understanding of the archive definitely framed my methodologies and the ways in which I was approaching and analyzing these sources. So I you know, naturally turned towards oral history as a method to supplement these sort of quote-unquote gaps in the archive. But I think even with oral histories, there are limitations. And I'd be curious to hear your opinion on this too. I mean, I think for oral histories, the person that you're speaking to, right, the way we're trained sort of becomes the primary source, right? Yeah. And so the actual name of that person is included in the study, unlike, say, for example, sociological or anthropological studies who sometimes use anonymous or different names to disguise or protect the privacy of the participant. In the history discipline, that's not the case, right? Yeah. And so from what I found in my research, it was actually really alienating in the community that I was working with. Again, a community that's been historically surveilled by the government, and there's this real distrust and fear for speaking on the record about their life experiences. And this was true for even my own relatives who were hesitant to speak with me on the record, right? So I struggled with finding folks who were comfortable to speak about this. And so I think this goes back to sort of then the question of the archive, question of epistemological and methodological questions of history. I mean, I certainly understand the logistics and reasons of including a name in an oral history, but I wonder what might be the possibilities for historians if we allowed for anonymous oral histories as valid, legitimate sources, right, in the scholarship that we produce. So yeah, I mean, I'm curious what your thoughts are about that too.
I think that's a great point. I mean, the stakes are so different, right? When you're interviewing people from marginalized communities who still mm-hmm. are under a certain level of danger, right? So the people that I interviewed, right, these ex-guerrilla fighters in the mountains of Mexico during the 60s and 70s, like they would tell me, you know, turn off your recorder. I'm going to tell you a story, but this is just for you because I'm going to tell you a story about when we kidnapped this rich landowner. But then I don't want you to record it because the landowner's relative that we murked, you know, they're still around. They're still trying to get me, right? Like to me, doing oral histories really collapse these fake distinctions between subject and object, but also between the past and the present. And for a lot of the folks that I've interviewed, like they're still in danger in the present because of things they did, you know, 30, 40 years ago. So I think you're right. I think it would expand, it would allow us to present both in terms of content, like a much richer historical narrative, but also in terms of form. I think it's a radical challenge to how we're trained as professionally trained as historians. But I, you know, this is where I, you know, interviewing people is where I learned about, you know, you ask people things and they don't always give you what you want them to give you, right? Like, right, so in many ways, sometimes you learn more about what they don't tell you. I mean, right. I remember I've interviewed women ex-guerrilla fighters who were imprisoned, and we would start talking about the moment when they were captured and interrogated, and they would stop, and they would let me understand in a certain way that they were stopping with me because a lot of sexual violence was involved, and that was my cue to be like, stop, this is it, right? So they're still living through that, or talking to interviewing elders in a community whose son was disappeared 40 years ago. Like for them, that history is still very present in the everyday and they're suffering it. So how do I ask these people about this horrific thing that happened to them that they're still experiencing? But if we're able to like somehow, you know, include that into our research and in our narratives, I think that's a powerful gesture, radical gesture.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, I think to read those gaps as just as important as, the material that we're given, that those gaps are, and those silences are just as telling. Absolutely. But I mean, even sometimes what you are told is then challenges the answer that you thought that you're going to receive. I mean, I interviewed my grandfather who didn't want his oral history to be part of my project, but still agreed to be recorded and to just for my family to have that recording. And I was, you know, just really interested in sort of the timeline of his work experiences, when he moved here, when he did XYZ, et cetera. And the interview turned out to be much more about the sort of emotional experiences that he had not growing up with his father, who worked on a British ship. He didn't know his father basically growing up in Yemen until he was much older and became a sailor himself. And so that really pushed me to think about the affective sides of these histories that I was looking at, right? So we sort of have this, again, because the archive prioritizes these institutional histories, we often lose that affective side and the sort of emotional and psychological effects that transforming a community into a transnational laboring class has on individuals and their families. So that was definitely a learning experience for me, for sure, during that oral history.
No, that's a powerful point. I think, and then you have subjects who all they want to do is talk. Like, my family's really mad at me that I haven't done research on their region, that I'm doing research on another part of Mexico. So they're still bugging me about, when are you going to research us? Right. And I'm like, oh man, I can't get you guys to be quiet. But no, it's also, I think, a way to get away from what we understand as the archive, right? So in Mexico, the National Archives are located in a 19th century Panopticon prison. So it's like very clear.
Wow.
Just doing research there, it's the links between state power and archive are like very clear and evident, right? Mm. So at least for my work, doing oral histories out in the field was a way to kind of counteract some of that, some of the institutional histories that you talk about. But it's by no means like this clear access to the past, right? It's just as fraught and complicated, and in some instances, it puts people in danger, right? So. That's also something to keep in mind. It's been an hour. Thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. Is there anything else that you want to bring up, discuss that we haven't gotten a chance to discuss? Anything that we missed?
I think we could talk a little bit about the sort of contemporary moment, right? I mean, I think, obviously my work doesn't cover what's happening in Yemen today. But I think there is just this need for historical context, right? That we're not getting in the media if and when Yemen is even covered.
Right.
And so, you know, being shown only in perpetual war and crisis, there's this process, I think, by which Yemen and its people become entirely ahistorical. And so I think
or to label it as a civil war, which like drives
exactly
me nuts. But, yeah,
right,
sorry, I interrupted,
right.
Sorry, go
which
ahead.
Which is no exactly which is representative of the lack of historical context that the region is given, right? That there's just no understanding of what's happening there, so I think there's just, you know, more than ever need for more historical scholarship on Yemen and its diaspora, which I think is connected to what's happening today. I mean, we're seeing, you know, organizing that's happening in the Yemeni American community today that really, I see the connections to the work that folks were doing in the 60s and 70s. So just quickly to talk about in 2017, when the Muslim ban happened, Yemeni Americans across the country were protesting and organizing in Brooklyn, where hundreds of Yemenis own the bodegas in Brooklyn. Over 5,000 of the Yemeni store owners there closed down their stores in 2017, protesting the Muslim ban. And this led to the creation of the Yemeni American Merchant Association shortly following that protest. And so, again, this is a contemporary example of how Yemenis in the diaspora continue to use their labor as sort of an ideological arena to contest these other politics related to U.S. empire, which include Islamophobia, right, surveillance, et cetera. And in striking, I think what these folks are saying is, you know, you want to ban us from this country when, in fact, we have been here and we have contributed to this economy through our labor. So I think the Brooklyn bodega strike is such a powerful example of the resourcefulness of in the Yemeni and the Yemeni American community.
That's great. That's an amazing point to end our this wonderful conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Alamri. Is there where can we find your work? I'll make sure to put your Boom California article and your dissertation in the show notes. But is there a place where we can find your work or anything else you'd like to plug?
Definitely check out my Boom article. I mean, as of now, as you know, the work doesn't stop with the dissertation. So no. I'm really just, you know, working on keeping my head down, turning this into a book manuscript, continuing this research, continuing to revise and draw these connections between these historical moments that I'm looking at. So yeah, I'm looking forward to see where this research will lead me next. But thank you so much for having me. This has been such a fun conversation to have.
No, thank you so much. And good luck with the manuscript and good luck with this, with the job market. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's go, Messatina Rabia.